Welcome, everybody. It's time once again for the next chapter with Charlie Hedges. As he explores turning the page on his life and yours. Hey, Charlie.
Hi, Paul. On our show today, we're privileged to have our regular insightful guest, Terry Hershey, a prolific author, renowned public speaker, landscape architect, a mentor to several people on, I like this, on the art of slowing down to take pleasure in life. My approach today for the show is really going to be unique. I've not heard anyone else try to do this, and so that means who knows if it's going to work. If you're a regular listener to our podcast and you've heard Terry several times, you know that Terry posts a weekly newsletter called Sabbath Moment, which is 1,000 to 1,100 words of really good writing on really good topics. And I want to do something a bit different today. What I want to do is read, I read several different Sabbath moments looking for a topic for today, and I kept copying and copying different quotes, and I decided all of these had value. There was so many good things that Terry had to say. So what I've decided to do today is to read quotes, or maybe extended quotes, from several different Sabbath moments, and ask Terry to comment or elaborate on that. So, Hersh, you think you're ready? You up for this?
I'm ready.
You're ready? You know you're going to have to defend yourself on some comments, so you're ready for that?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting. So let's start there. That's curious, defending oneself. It's interesting that we're afraid to speak from the heart, because when I write Sabbath Moment, I speak from the heart, and I'm speaking more from the heart now than I did at any time in my life. Because I'm about 65, so whatever that's called, the second half of life. And so I don't see it as defending so much as introducing myself to the people I'm talking to.
You have aged well. That's a very mature comment. Why do I have to defend myself if I believe in this? This is what I believe in. It's sound. It's reasonable. It's not hurting anybody. And who knows? It could, if we were to implement some of these things, it could help our individual life and our corporate life. So I don't have to defend that.
Yeah, and you know as well as I do, in the church world, which we were both in for some time, there are a lot of people who are going to take exception to things you say.
Oh my goodness! Are you kidding?
And you know, I used to bristle and have all kinds of conundrums and conniption fits you know, I'd occasionally use the Lord's name in vain. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I know that one.
And the thing is, at some time I realized I needed to not bite, and I needed to take at face value what they were saying. And so then if I'm not biting, if I'm okay with who I am and taking at face value what they're saying, then in fact, I may learn something about what I said, and I may have to adjust what I said, or I may have to explain better what I said. So, yes, the answer to
am I going to get too personal if I ask you to tell the story of what you told me that when you were speaking at a very popular, event, and you spoke in the 70s when your views were differently? Is that too personal?
No, not at all. No.
Tell that story, because I think that's a really good story, Terry.
Well, in the 70s, I was 6 years old, and I was only in elementary.
Okay.
I was a pastor at a church in Southern California that was pretty well known, called the Crystal Cathedral. It is now called Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove. But the point is, I was at a big venue, and one of my assignments was single adults. And I was an up-and-comer. I was young, very young. And
Yeah, you were the man in those days.
We would have these gatherings of about 1,000 people from around the country coming to learn about how to do ministry. And so one of the things they wanted to learn about was single adults. How do you get single people in your church? And so somebody asked the question. There was a Q&A, because I did a thing, and there was a Q&A. And one of the questions, what do you do with gay? And I don't even know if they use gay. They might use homosexual back then. But what do you use gay or homosexual single adults? And I said, and this is a, and anybody who's part of been part of a church culture in their life will recognize this talking point. I said, well, we love the sinner, but we hate the sin.
Which right. That's very common phrase in
which, if you unpack it, literally means nothing.
Yeah, really. What does that mean?
It's just a nice way to smile and get yourself off the hook from committing. So after that was over, and that all sounds good. After that was over, a man, a priest, Episcopal priest came to me who happened to be a friend of mine, social friend, and who is gay. And he said to me, don't ever do that again. And I said, why? He said, because that's not who you are. I know you, and you don't believe that. I mean, if you believe it, fine, but I know you. So don't, and what he meant by, he didn't mean don't say that particular thing again. He said, don't not be you.
What kind of lesson was that to you?
Yeah, well, of course. And the whole, because what I realized was, so many of, and then I had to think through, so many of my responses were not really me. They were predicated on, what did my audience want to hear? What was going to get me in good stead? What was going to score points?
Score points, get more audience, sell books, raise your level of popularity, rather than being honest. And in those days, you know, geez, that could have gotten you excommunicated, you know, because...
Right. And so, yeah. It's interesting. You always check, how is this going to get me in trouble before I actually say what's true to my spirit?
Until you get old. Then you just don't give a rat.
Exactly.
I hope that's true. I hope that's true because
you have become
much more. It's not like you weren't open, but you're not. You know, you don't play, and you never really played by the party line. But there is still a difference now than there used to be. There's much more of a self comfort than there used to be. Maybe more comfortable in your own skin, if you've ever heard that term.
Yes. No, in fact, that's I actually love that term.
I know. I'm teasing you.
Oh, I get it. At home in your own skin is what I yearn. When you're around somebody who's at home in your own skin, you want to be next. You want to be near them. You want to be connected.
What is it about them? What makes them different? How can you tell somebody is at home in their own skin? Do you have any clues?
They're not scanning the room for approval, for starters. And they're not cowering in shame. And they're not twitching for some need for affirmation.
All the things that are the goals of our society.
Right. And they're comfortable with several things. They're comfortable with silence. They're comfortable with not needing to comment. They're comfortable with not needing to fix. They're comfortable with not needing to correct. They're comfortable with several things. Someone at home in their own skin, I was going to say resignation, but it's not a resignation. But there's a settledness there.
Yes, that's a good word, a settledness.
There's no racing about. And you can tell someone racing about. I'm in awe of such people.
That was perfect. That was a great start. If we be half that good throughout the rest of this odd podcast, I'm going to be delighted. For the audience to know, I could be switching subjects. You know, I'm not on any one particular subject. These are just things that you wrote that impressed me, that I wanted to hear you comment on because I thought they were good. This is going to be the longest quote. So I want to warn everybody, you know, it's like three or four sentences.
Let me say this. The interesting thing about Sabbath moment, the irony, given what we are, the irony of the conversation we had leading up to this is, it's one thing that links every Sabbath moment to one another is, how do we find ourselves at home in our own skin? How grounded? How are we grounded?
You know, that really is true, isn't it? You know, it has a lot to do with that. So now we're going to talk about...
I live in a, yeah.
We're going to talk about grounding and brokenness. And you wrote the following, and bear with me, I'll read it slowly. We have been marinated in a narrative of scarcity. In other words, I'm not enough. We've been marinated in that narrative. So it is no surprise that we ascribe beauty to only the uncluttered and success to only the strong or powerful. When we pause and hear the voice of grace, trusting our sufficiency, we are no longer afraid of the brokenness and woundedness. They are not a threat to our wholeness. And here's the quote that I have highlighted. In embracing our wounds, they become, as Richard Rohr reminds us, sacred wounds because grace is alive and well. I'll repeat that last sentence because that's the one we're going to focus some time on. In embracing our wounds, they become sacred wounds because grace is alive and well. And yet, before I come to talking about our sacred woundedness, I really want to know what for you is the grace, is the voice of grace. What does that mean?
The affirmation that that you are enough. I mean, I don't know if you're going to quote something else. The Sabbath moment I wrote last week about the Aboriginal tribe that when they greet each other.
Oh, yes.
They greet each other. They say, you are, instead of, they don't say hello or hi. They don't have words for those. Their word, this is in Papua New Guinea. They say, you are here. And your response is, as I am. And so on that, remember the greeting in Avatar?
No, I don't.
They didn't greet each other with hello there either. In Avatar, they said, I see you.
Yeah, sort of like two empiricists talking together.
No, but I see you means, because you know what it's like when you're with somebody, Charlie, that actually gets you. And they don't need you to be a different Charlie. They don't need you to be a better Charlie. They don't need you to be a worse Charlie. They don't need you to be a funny Charlie. They don't need you to be a Charlie with money. They don't need you to be, they've already bought in there with Charlie.
So that voice of grace to you is an accepting and affirming voice.
You are enough.
You are enough. Yeah, I like that. I like that. So let's go on. That gives me grist to go on. You write that we are in embracing our wounds. They become sacred wounds because grace is alive and well. How has that revealed itself in your life? Because, you know, you've experienced, as all of us, several wounds. How does embracing the woundedness as opposed to sort of sealing ourselves off from it empower us?
Well, I'll tell you a quick story real quick, then I'll tell you about how it fleshed out for me. So a young kid goes by the pet store and he sees there's these little puppies and so he goes in and says, and they were going to be like $50. So he goes in and says, I want to see the puppies. And the man humors him, says, okay. And so the mom dog comes out followed by all these puppies. And there's one puppy that's limping badly. And he said, I'll take that one. And the man laughs and says, well, that was not for sale, son, because nobody really wants that puppy. There's no need to have that puppy. And he said, no, I want that puppy. And he, you know, reaches in to get cash out of his pocket. And he said, he's got like $4 cash. I'm going to pay you this, and then I'll pay you every week until I have enough to have that puppy. And, you know, the man said, son, you don't get it. The puppy's damaged. And the young boy said, no, I want that puppy. And then he rolls up his pant leg and shows, he's a polio victim, so he's got a brace down his old leg. And he says, someday someone needs to understand that puppy, and I want to be that one. At some point, you got to know when to roll up your leg and realize where you're also broken. And that happened for me the very first time. I admitted to an audience while I was speaking that I suffer from periods of depression. See, I never wanted to say that to anybody because that's the brokenness. You don't admit stuff like that. That's crazy. Why would you talk about that? And so, and I talked about where I was and who I was and what goes on with that. And of course, I do that with different parts. Now, there's a point at which you decide how much of it is simply using the audience to
right.
get off for your own gain, which is fair. I get that. There's a reality to that. But to answer your question, there was a point where I finally was not, I was no longer afraid to say that is a wound I carry.
Yeah, but you know, even more important, Terry, than admitting it to an audience is really coming to the point where you truly embrace that for yourself. That it is not admitting it to an audience, it's admitting it to you.
And to your point, not renaming it something, you know, oh, I just have moments of sadness or whatever. There's lots of things I could say, but yes, you're right.
Yeah. Now, you know, I totally believe in embracing our woundedness, and I know for me that it is it's helped me learn, and it's helped me cope, and it's also been I'm thinking of a word that I can't think of. It's an apology, not asking forgiveness, but in apologetics for God that will identifies us in our brokenness and understands our brokenness.
And I would say naming it. Naming is a powerful, powerful thing. When you name something, you bring it out of hiding. You're part of an organization that even to be in the organization, you have to name something. You have to say it. That's your first step.
Oh, the first, you got the first step. It is naming two things. Yeah, absolutely. And without that first step, the rest of it is a waste of time.
Yeah, and there's no need to feel shame about it once you name it, because now the wound can be sacred. It can be a place of healing and restoration. In other words, that's not the only reality about you.
You know,
the brace was not the only reality about the boy with polio.
Right. I don't know if I've told this story on the podcast before. I've told many of my stories, so I may have. But I had a mentor in seminary, and he had a character defect, and that he was a public flasher, and he was caught. And so, obviously, in a conservative religious institution, he lost his job, but it finally came out. You know, it had been a part of his life for so long. It had been a part of his life through college, and you know, and in this particular discipline, he had to hide it more than other. You know, you have to hide that in any disciplines, but you know, in the religious discipline, you have to hide it even more. And he came back to me after, you know, he had gone through a bunch of this, and he told me, you know, there's a passage in one of the books in the Bible called James, and he writes, confess your sins to one another, brethren, or confess, my term would be confess your brokenness to one another, brethren, in order that you might be healed. And you know what he said about that, about the confession, about admitting it to himself and admitting it to others? He says, confession, or letting this out, or admitting this, what his words were, blocks the blackmail of Satan. Now, whether you believe in this satanic figure or not, but it blocks the internal voices that are putting you down. Now, they no longer have power. You've disempowered them by admitting them and by saying, okay, I am this, and now I'm going to have to deal with that. Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. And I mean, I don't believe in Satan, but the point is, I do believe in the fact that there are narratives of scarcity which play that same role, that blackmail us. That's what shame does. It blackmails us.
Exactly.
It assumes your narrative is scarcity, and I get that. And so owning it, so I mean, and so we don't do it. And this is the power, because owning is a big deal. That's owning means this is me. This is who I don't need to run from this anymore. And which means, therefore, I will make choices with regard to it. if it is detrimental. For example, if I go to AA and I say, "Hi, my name's Terry and I'm an alcoholic," well, that's fine. But there's not a period at the end of that sentence. There's a comma that says, "Therefore, I choose to. Here's what I choose to honor. Because of that, because I've been able to name that, I will choose to honor the following things." And I can do that. I have the courage to do that because the honoring of that wound is not detrimental to my capacity to be a fully human person.
That's powerful. That's a great statement, that the honor, that the admitting of the wound does not give it power. It reduces its power.
Yeah, in other words, the power now is in that. That's the scary part, though, Charles. This is the scary part. The power now is back in my camp. In other words, so therefore, what am I going to do? That's the scary part. That's why we don't want to admit it, because now we have to do something. Now we own our lives. Now we make choices.
Yeah, and we can and we can make a choice to ignore it, and pay the price for it.
Absolutely.
You know, Richard Rohr, in his latest book, "The Universal Christ," I believe it's called.
Yeah. We were talking about that.
Yeah, it's a very fascinating book, and I love it because it's so controversial. Because he's saying truth that is not normal Western truth. It's Eastern truth, but it's not Western truth. I mean, Eastern Christianity, not Western Christianity. But he talks about the cross of Christ as being essential for life, and that he was an example of going through, horrific misery, but he came out of that after having gone through it, willingly gone through that. He came out of that a stronger person. You know, in many eyes, he became deity, or was already deity, but it was acknowledged, but that he needed to go through that experience, that of the cross and the beatings and the death. Do you relate to that?
He didn't run from it. That was for certain. In other words, he didn't say, if it weren't for that, I would have been an amazing Messiah.
How good I would have looked, but how much good would I have done?
The good he would have done is predicated on him being grounded and speaking from the core of who he was.
And that's what embracing your brokenness is being grounded in your core and admitting that, working on it, or sometimes learning to live with it. It depends on situations are not easy.
Yeah, I don't know the answer. It depends, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to another subject, a whole different subject this time, that you wrote, and I'm just gonna read one sentence. And this kind of came right after one of the things I've probably already talked about, but you put, it's paradigm shift time. Time to move from a project management view of life to a weighed-in view of life. Time to move from a project management view of life, which I wholly agree, and to wade in into a wade in view of life. How do you wade into your life, Terry?
Project management means you're over and above it, and you start a lot of your sentences with if, only, and when. And so life is not yet now. I mean, life is not yet, nor is life now.
And if I may interject, it's also filled with goals. Project management life is just filled with so many achievable goals and check marks.
It's the same thing we do with my life will be good when I finish my bucket list, which is a goal list. I have no problem with bucket lists. It's just that you already have a life. Your bucket list is gravy. But and so do it, but try it. But wade in means, for example, a woman is telling me her story. She's only in her 30s, but her story is sad, her life story. And so she starts to cry. Well, she's starting to cry. So she's already telling me these things about her. And she starts to cry. What do you think the next sentence out of her mouth is?
I'm sorry.
See? I didn't even prompt you. That was her next sentence. Think about this for a minute. That's project management. Her life is sadness right now, and wading in means live there. Give yourself the permission to live there. And I'm thinking, I'm sorry? I'm sorry for what? For actually having emotions? See, think of what we do with project management, which I call project management. I'm not trying to be detrimental or putting a moral price tag on the phrase. I'm just thinking, think what we do with our life. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for being human. Wow. That we have to somehow distance ourselves from where we are in the thick of life. Wading in means it's okay right now for me to feel this. It's okay for me to be here. And because when I say that, then I'm able to hold it and name it. You're vacuum naming. Because now I own it. I get to have responsibility for it. I get to choose. It's a remarkable thing. Even, and her second sentence was, I shouldn't feel this way.
That's so disheartening to hear that kind of statement. And yet, it's probably more common than not.
Yes, it's common across the board, regardless of...
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. It's a common statement among people in our life.
It's not even the property of just religious people.
No, of course not. Of course not.
Yeah.
Of course not. And I like the idea of wading in, testing the waters, not just jumping in, of wading in, of taking your, checking it out piece by piece and working through it bit by bit, bird by bird, as Anne Lamott says.
Well, because I don't know what this holds yet. I know I'll be the young woman. I know that I'm completely overrun with sadness, and I don't know what it means, and I don't know why I'm sad, and I don't know where it will take. But I'm not going to run from it, so to your point.
Yes, exactly. And I admit that I am sad, and that.
I just don't know. Or start with what I do know. I'll start there. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Go ahead.
No. I'll start there.
Okay, well, we're going to start after a break, and I've got another question for you. I'm having fun doing this. Are you having fun doing this?
Yeah, I love doing this.
Yeah, okay, great. Let's take a quick break. Hi, you're listening to The Next Chapter with Charlie Hedges, and this is Charlie, and I'm here with my good friend Terry Hershey, and we are doing something very different today. He has a post-Sabbath moment that's a newsletter that comes out weekly, and I am taking bits and pieces of his Sabbath moment and asking him to explain it, and I'm realizing... I thought, oh, shoot, I don't have enough quotes, and I do. So here's another one for you, Terry, that I really liked, and this is just a seven-worder or so. Life is not to be contained, explained, or fixed. I really like that. It's falling in line with what we've been talking about. It's giving even a greater opening that we cannot contain life, we don't have to explain life, and we don't even have to fix it. That has to do that maybe even comes with embracing brokenness, that we don't necessarily have to fix it, that it's going to be broken. God forbid, you talk to parents whose children have died young. They're, that can't be fixed. You don't get over that. That can't be fixed. There's a way to manage life around it. That can't be fixed. And there's so many things in our life that can't be contained or explained or fixed. Give me some of your thoughts on that.
When you come out of seminary, one of the assumptions, and I'm not going to blame the seminary, one of the assumptions you have as a young clergy is that your job is to do all three of those things.
Exactly. That is a great observation.
And so you need to be good, two things. You need to be good at that, and you need to be good at hiding the fact that you can't do that for yourself.
You know, I was warned when I left seminary. I had an advisor that I wasn't close to. I mean, I liked him. We were friends, but I didn't really use him as an advisor. And so as I left seminary, I asked him his advice. You know, what advice? You know, you've been with me for 3 years. What advice do you have for me? He says, Charlie, this I have against you. You have a proclivity for the novel, which means you don't contain, explain, or fix when you have a proclivity for the novel, because you're looking for something different. You're looking for a new idea.
Right. Part of it is unlearning the stuff that you have sort of taken to heart early on. That's not really the nature of the game.
Like what? Explain that.
Well, that my job is to fix life, explain life.
Right.
My favorite story was the kid who came, the little girl came home from school, and she's crying. Her mother's thinking, oh, Lord. And she's saying, what happened? Well, my best friend, her cat died. Oh, my Lord. That, you know, because the girl's like nine, you know. So sad, your friend cat died, and I'm sorry. He said, why are you sad? And said, because I was a terrible friend. Why? He said, because I didn't know what to say to her. Well, the mom said, well, what'd you do? And the little girl said, well, I just held her hand and cried with her all day.
Yeah. How much better do you get than that?
You start there. I don't know what to say, but I'll be with you. How about that? We'll see where we go. But I use a phrase. It was from the 1700s. Somebody coined it. It's called the sacrament of the present moment. I love that. Sacrament means container of grace. We talked about grace being, this is enough. Well, the present moment is a sacrament of grace. Now, how do we do that? If I'm going to go down to El Paso today and talk to parents who lost kids and kids who lost parents, I cannot contain this. I cannot fix this. I cannot explain this. But damn it, I'll hold your hand and cry with you today.
Yeah, I'll be with you.
Because I'm not going to run from the moment. I'm not going to run from the brokenness of the moment. I'm not going to run from it. It's broken, completely broken. But there's a wholeness somewhere that we will find together if we allow ourselves to be here in this moment and not try to create some sort of reality.
And yet, you know, in a most important time in our country, in our political system, our people, our pundits, the people in the you know, running for office, all want to do that, don't they? Or mainly most of them, I can't say all, want to contain, explain, or fix.
Yeah, and it's a troublesome conundrum.
And we expect that of them.
Yes. However, but I think this is also what explains what is going on with our culture politically. Because in lieu of that, we'll just take belonging. If we feel like we belong somewhere, the tribal aspect that takes care of it. We don't need to fix anything. At one level, I get it. I understand. Because people want to feel like, I'm okay, I'm safe here, I belong. That's what's going on with these young men who shoot everybody. They have a place they belong.
Yeah, I don't, you know, I certainly think that is a major aspect of it. I'm looking through my questions here, and I think two or three of them are kind of leading back to what things that we've already talked about. I do want to talk about one before I get to the final question, and that is a quote you use from Robert Fulghum. And tell me, I'm not familiar with Fulghum. Who is he?
Everything I learned in kindergarten.
Oh, okay, okay. He said, I came to understand that I am not the source or the light. You know, as you and I, as you talk about frequently, you are the light of the world, and your light is, and let your light shine, but that light is not brought on by you, it's brought on by something else. So he says, I came to understand that I am not the, I am not the light or the source of the light, but light, truth, understanding, and knowledge is there, and it will only shine in many dark places if I reflect it. This is what I am about. This is the meaning of life. I love that.
I think it's fabulous, yeah.
Yeah, I love that quote, that it is my job not to contain, explain, or fix, but to shine a light in a place of darkness. And that light can be nothing but love, or it can be, it can just be friendship. It can just be, I'll sit here and hold your hand, or I'll sit here next to you if you don't want to be touched. You know, I will honor what is right for you, and just to let you know that I care. And sometimes that person doesn't want to be bothered, but, you know, three or four really kind words go so far, Terry. They go so far to that person who will...
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. Because the thing about the light is, I mean, the way I was raised, you know, and all kids sang, no matter what, whether they're children of religion or not, you know, this is the light of mine. We all know that song. And nobody sings it better than Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, I know. You love that.
He can sing it. But the point is, you know, Jesus never said, make the light. He didn't say, create the light. He just said, get out of the way. It's just shine it. There's something to that. And sometimes we get it when times are tough or rough, because we just step in where we didn't think we had the capacity to step in. By step in, I mean, be a presence for healing and kindness and empathy and reclamation and restoration and all of these things.
And focus on that person that is being, that you're ministering to or associating with, and rather than looking all over the room and looking for someone else to talk to, that your eyes are 100% focused on them, and they are the 100% of your attention is on them.
Yeah, you know that saying, I say that, Mama, Mama, listen to me, said the little boy, but this time with your eyes.
With your eyes. Yeah. Let me know that you're really there. Okay, let's wrap this time up and get to what you and producer Paul, my final question is one that I know has grabbed a deep part of your heart personally, and that is the state of our nation and its current president. Now, I know this could lead you and producer Paul to a rant, but I plan to avoid that, and we can just we can talk about it. You wrote, I'm in a place where, for the first time in my life, I welcome a tender heart. The growth that you're going through is just amazing me. And you wrote this, and I would like you to, we can spend some time on this. This past week, I was speaking to a group who asked me, how can we give time to personal and community renewal in a world that is on fire with hate and pain? I will repeat that question. How can we give time to personal and community renewal in a world that is on fire with hate and pain? And your answer was, we can't afford not to. How do you do that when you see a country that is certainly in the worst point in your and my history, and maybe for, who knows? I mean, I didn't live in other presidencies, so, I mean, you know, back 100 years ago, so, but right now we're at a scary place in our country. And people are reluctant to get involved because they don't believe in the system. They don't believe in its politicians. As you and I talk today, whether you're a Trump fan or not a Trump fan, you know, the question you raise, we said we could do a whole podcast on, although I'm not expert enough to do it, on the DNC. Can't the DNC, you know, what are they doing in their debates that are bringing hope to a country? What is going on here that we just, you know, it just seems to be vitriol and not issues. What do we need to do? How are we going to help this country? You know, how can I lead this country as the president of the United States? You know, we don't seem to be getting there, Terry. We seem to be just in this horrible cycle of bullyism and name calling.
When you're stuck in fear, when there's elements of insecurity that some part of my world feels threatened, and when some part of my world feels threatened, I circle the wagons, and so I'm afraid of what threatens it. That's at one level. Some people can take advantage of that fear, and then they can start to name the reasons you should be afraid and the reason you should circle the wagons and the reasons the people outside are going to do what they're going to do to you. Which is a fascinating thing, because that's predicated, in and of itself, that's predicated on the notion is that you need to be afraid of what's outside of you and circle your wagons because you are not enough. The antithesis of everything we said at the beginning. Because if I'm enough, then the person I look at, I see you. You are there, then you are enough. I mean, I don't know if I agree or disagree. That doesn't matter right now, but we start there. But see, we can't start there. If I'm not enough, I've got to circle my wagons, and I've got to hate. And so much of my fuel comes from that need to hate. And here's the thing about, you said, can I do anything about it without renewal? And that's the thing. My capacity for doing anything, and by doing anything means, how do I create a world where I live as a human, and I connect with others who are human. In other words, there's dignity there. There's dignity. I see you. I see you. And so if I see you, then I relate to you with empathy and kindness.
Yeah, that statement makes even more sense. That I see you makes even more sense in this context.
And so now, none of what I've said has anything to do with a political party. None.
No.
But the point is, if I don't see myself, Charlie, in that way, how can I see you in that way? No wonder I'm afraid. No wonder I lash out. If there's no self-kindness, self-compassion going toward me, then instead of whatever I get involved with is not going to be helping others find compassion, helping others. Think, for example, if you go to Uganda to help drill a well for people, but you go there because you go there on the fuel that you're so pissed off at some government in Uganda or some people in Uganda, what kind of wells are you drilling?
That's great. If I go there with a pure heart.
I just say, I want people to start with, I mean, yeah, you can shout at people who disagree, shout at me all you want or be angry, but I want a place where we can offer that to people around us. I want that. And no, you know what? No, I want to do that. I want to offer that. I mean, I don't need to hold anybody else to task. I need to do that. I feel strongly about this, yeah.
Yeah, I know. I'm feeling stronger and stronger myself. Not that I hadn't felt strongly about it, but it's becoming a significant issue with me. I worked with a man who was the president CEO of a waste management company. Prior to that, he was with the Environmental Protection Agency. He was the commissioner in charge of that. He was a commissioner of the DEP for the state of New Jersey. And he made an observation about business and government. He said, the goal of business is to succeed. The goal of government is not to fail. Ooh. And that is that's a tremendous difference in how you approach the way you govern or the way you manage your affairs. If you're trying not to fail rather than trying to succeed. And that's what hit, that was his discovery working in, you know, some higher levels of government.
Yeah, and so to that point, I would say in the same way as being a parent, in my case, being a father, I mean, I don't know what succeeding means, but the not failing means, I'll tell you what, and I have one son, I'll tell you what, son, I will do everything within my power to create a place for you where your dignity is enhanced and your identity, you know the sufficiency of who you are. I will do that. And to not do that would be to fail. So I get that. I get that.
Yeah. All right. I want to wrap it up with one quote. You can make a comment on it, but it's a quote that I think kind of sums up much of what we've talked about, and quoting Thomas Merton, and you were writing in your post, perhaps it's no coincidence that today's gospel reading is the story of the Good Samaritan. I like Thomas Merton's take. Our job is to love others without stopping to inquire whether or not they are worthy. Our job is to love others without stopping to inquire whether or not they are worthy. That is not our business. In fact, it is nobody's business. All we are asked to do is love. How do you get better than that?
I can't.
Terry, thank you so much for taking time and out of your... I know you have a very... very trying schedule right now, and I want to thank you for taking the time in your schedule to talk with us here on the Next Chapter with Charlie. Take care, my friend.
Just sounded like you and me talking over beers, Charles. That was good.
I know. I know, buddy.
All right.